everyone, and welcome to the Shedcasts, to the British Constitution and Law series, episode 36C, Revolutions. Now, before I start, I have been asked by Christine to make the point that when the Tudors introduced the rule of using only English in courts, it came at a time when the vast majority of ordinary people in Wales did not speak English at all and were monoglot Welsh speakers. This raises an interesting topic that Christine's point inspired me to explore a little further. I'm not entirely sure it fits in a discourse about the British Constitution, but hopefully you'll find it interesting enough, so indulge me. And this is about the impact generally on the Welsh language and the intention of the change. Was this an attack by the Tudors on Welsh language and culture, effectively? Some of the modern attitude towards the history of minority languages is inevitably affected by a modern link between nationalism and language. Not everyone agrees, but many modern commentators have included language in their definition of nationalism. The conclusion, then, has therefore been that the Tudors had a deliberate policy of suppressing minority languages. So, for example, one historian, Victor Derkatz, points out that policies have varied according to time and concludes, only in the 16th and 17th centuries can it be said that they were brutally suppressed by central government, which in this period followed a rigid policy of linguistic uniformity in the Celtic periphery. Historian Gwyn Williams agrees, using the phrase brutally expelled from political life. Well, other historians disagree. Let's go first of all to the original Act, Clause 17, which reads, "All justices, commissioners, sheriffs, coroners, escheators, stewards and their lieutenants and all other officers and ministers of law shall proclaim and keep the session courts and all other courts in English." To add to this, all office holders had to speak English. I've seen this described as banning Welsh speakers in office. It's not. It is, in fact, a requirement for bilingualism. So, it's very probably incorrect to think that the Tudors were trying to eradicate the Welsh language, because the Act needs to be seen in the context of the drive by Renaissance states to create coherence and efficiency in their administrative process as part of state formation. The background to this is that the jurisdictions in Wales before Thomas Cromwell were very complex. There were the marches and then there were the Principality of Wales, which were governed in different ways to most parts of England. Cromwell's changes were not unique to Wales. Just as Wales was transformed for the first time in its history into a unitary entity, it was to be governed by a council. And there were similar councils elsewhere, in the north in particular, but also the Duchy of Cornwall and in parts of Ireland. The Act was in fact about simplifying and strengthening administration. The standardisation of justice was part of that policy. "That's all very well," I hear you cry, "but simplifying administration presumably therefore included standardising language and squeezing Welsh speakers out of office." Well, not a bit of it, really. There is plenty of evidence that the Tudors quite understood that to be successful, their administration must be sympathetic to the vernacular. So, the requirement for office holders would have had very little impact, because the gentry, who would be the only aspirants to any official posts, by and large were already bilingual by this stage. In addition, provision was made for interpreters in court to make sure that monoglot litigants and witnesses could plead and give evidence. And in addition, it was specifically stipulated that royal proclamations and orders of council were to be read out in Welsh. Now, these are not the actions of a government trying to suppress the local language or even disadvantage them. There's more. I think I have talked about the development of the Bible and prayer book into Welsh. This work was done by Bishop William Morgan and others, but the work was specifically commissioned by the Tudor government through a statute of 1563. Uniformity in religion was critical as far as the Tudors were concerned, and they recognised the need to be sensitive to local language. Even in Ireland, some Gaelic publications were used, and where services in English was a problem, ministers were authorised to use the previously customary Latin, a concept, of course, very alien to Protestantism, which stressed the vernacular and involvement. So, in fact, the Tudors recognised that it was in their interests to promote local language, not suppress it. Nor were the Tudors antithetical to Welsh culture, and in return, nor were many of the ruling elite in Wales opposed to Tudor government, although it's a bit more difficult to know what ordinary folks believed. So, all these translators in the church were enthusiastic about Welsh culture. They worked to help it flourish. Bishop Richard Davis appealed to his countrymen, "Do not denationalise yourself and do not be indifferent. Do not look down, but gaze upwards to the place where you belong." But at the same time, they professed admiration for the Tudors for returning the ancient unity of Britain. In return, the Tudors saw no need to be hostile to Welsh culture. Henry VII, of course, had lived in Wales for 14 years and spoke Welsh. Wales was embedded in the outrageous popular history of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey Monmouth. Historian Gwyn Williams again wrote about the role played at the Tudor court by Welsh humanists, who were connected not only with their own tradition, but were integrated into English and European culture and thought. They were deeply Welsh, Welsh patriots who knew no conflict of language. They used English as centrally as Latin. They were particularly European in formation. This has turned into a major digression, but sorry, just a couple more points. The first is that the actions of the Tudors were thoroughly unexceptional. In Scotland, both King and Parliament were determined to ensure that all their clan chiefs and magnates spoke English, especially in the Gaelic Highlands, specifying in the Statute of Iona that children be educated to speak English. Actually, the Scottish Parliament was quite blood-curdling in its stated desire to eradicate the Gaelic language. The same sort of thing occurs in France. In 1539, the Ordinance of Villers-Cotterêts demanded the use of the langue d'oil in all legal acts and contracts. Although minority languages were referred to rather contemptuously as patois, the intention was not to legislate against minority languages like Breton, Picard, Occitan, and Catalan. In fact, it was more to remove the use of Latin, but mainly to make sure that there were no confusions created by differing translations and languages. Now, later attitudes became more aggressive during the French Revolution, but that's a different story, and I'm only speaking of the Tudor period, which is all I've read about, so we'll leave the future to the future. Just to finish up then, the Tudors had no intention to eradicate the use of Welsh, rather to encourage it, and Welsh culture was connected to Renaissance culture both in Britain and Europe. Having said that, of course, there may have been a law of unintended consequences here. Some have argued that the 16th century saw the start of the decline in minority languages, as the vernacular became associated purely with the working classes, which affected public attitudes. But that's a long way off in Tudor times, where the gentry were not English monoglot speakers, but bilingual. That's it then. End of that rather massive digression. If there is a connection with the British Constitution, it lies in the fact that the Tudor period, as in much of Europe, was critical for state formation, and the formation of unified states was a critical requirement of modern constitutions. Anyway, so here then, in the third of our series, we present much more mayhem than we have done before. A level of mayhem that makes Simon de Montfort look like a goody two-shoes, or a goody two-mailed boots, or whatever. There's a long tradition in English history that everything's much calmer and evolutionary than those overexcitable continental types. Well, maybe. But not in this episode, folks. Not in this episode. We arrived last time at the end of Good Queen Bess and the transformations of the Tudors, all jolly important, as I have impressed firmly on you. But those Tudors were to be given a good lesson in the old constitutional change front. We start off with our first King of Britain. Well, first if you discount any relevant egg kings like Athelstan. James VI of Scotland and the First of England was our first King of Britain. Jimmy was terribly keen to just squish England and Scotland together like you do with a couple of old, almost used up cakes of soap to make them last longer. Bit of water, bit of squishing, Bob's your uncle. One cake of soap, no one can tell the difference, even if one half is pink and the other smells of seaweed and has little bits in it. However, the two bars of soap were neither of them keen at all at the prospect of being so squidged, and they slipped and slid around until James left the bathroom in disgust. Tell me if I am pushing the soap metaphor too far, by the way. But essentially, you'll have to wait another 100 years or more for soap squishing. Jimmy VI and First had been given a brutal education by a chap called George Buchanan, a renowned scholar at the time, who firmly believed in the right of the people to remove monarchs they didn't like, and spent his time beating this philosophy into his young charge, so much so that James was troubled by nightmares for the rest of his life. The result of this brand of child-centred learning was that James very firmly rejected any such philosophy, however strong it remained in many parts of Scottish thinking. James was a thoughtful and intelligent man who wrote poetry, wrote on witchcraft and on kingship for his son. The advice he gave to his son was that the king was firmly above the law and accountable to no higher authority except God, who was honestly way too busy to tip up Parliament and cause trouble. He also, though, made the point that the king was also responsible for delivering good government as part of the deal. Now, James was a skillful politician, and by the time he arrived in England, he was an experienced and successful king. But he underestimated just how different the bicameral English Parliament was in comparison to the unicameral Scottish Parliament, where tradition retained the right of the king to promulgate laws independent of Parliament through a small convention, which made the whole thing much easier to control. In addition to which, there was a monumental clash of egos going on between two huge names of English history. Largely speaking in the King's corner was Francis Bacon, Lord Chancellor for a while, a man famed for his legal skills but even more for his works on natural philosophy and the scientific method. And much later, of course, he was to take up painting. Jokes. In the common law corner was Edward Coke, famed as one of England's greatest jurists and possessor of one of those surnames which are clearly spelled wrongly. Coke being spelled C-O-K-E, which is a travesty of spelling. The two of them, Coke and Bacon, absolutely hated each other. And there was a gag in there somewhere about Edward Coke cooking his bacon when Bacon fell from grace, thrown to the wolves by the king, but I just can't find its elegant expression. So, ideas on a postcard. Sadly, it appears that neither of these men achieved greatness by being nice guys. Both of them tended to arrogance and to bullying. Coke seems particularly nasty, flogging his daughter to make her marry to further his political position. And his death was lamented by his wife with these words, "We shall never see his like again. Praises be to God." Francis Bacon fought largely on the basis of the king's view of the supreme power of the monarch. And it's worth noting that in a European context, much of continental Europe often without the same strength of representative institutions as England, was at this stage heading towards absolutism, which is where Bacon's view felt that England should also be bound. It had been argued that the king's prerogatives were given to him by the common law, but Bacon replied with staple absolutist argument that the king held his prerogatives mediately from the law, but immediately from God. Mediately. Nice word. So, although the king's prerogative might look to come from law, really, it didn't. It came from God, said Bacon. So, you know, that's trumped your common law cook, my lad. When later James tried to raise money by making up new financial impositions, James being one of the most financially incontinent monarchs we've ever had, Bacon was right in there, claiming that it was part of the royal prerogative. But Parliament could not be doing with such a thing, and the king was forced by them to back down. The principle that the king could levy no new financial impositions without parliamentary approval would be enshrined in the 1628 Petition of Right. Other small steps forward were won by Parliament at the time, particularly the right of the Commons to determine its own composition. When the King tried to bar an outlawed Member of Parliament from taking up his seat, this right was another small but important step towards the independence of Parliament. James I and Cook clashed constantly over the power of the King's prerogative through the Courts of Equity, which James was very keen on indeed, for it was to him the perfect expression of kingliness, an arbitrary power of the king to wave his hands and temper justice with mercy. In the end, James cut the Gordian knot of dispute by firing his Chief Justice Cook and ruling for 7 years without calling Parliament, in which case there is an interesting parallel with his son. And like his son, he came a cropper because he ran out of money, despite selling offices and baronetcies like warm lardy cakes. When Parliament returned, it immediately started a barney over the King's contention that parliamentary privilege came about by royal grant. Because if you were looking for a black eye in 1621, your best course of action was to walk into Parliament and casually mention that Parliament only existed because the king was a grade A stand-up kind of guy and allowed it all graciously to happen from the good of his heart. In response, Parliament grandly announced that Parliament's privileges were the ancient and undoubted birthright and inheritance of the subjects of England. Now then, this is a thing to remember, because this is part of the philosophy that means that Edward Cook, for all that he was a bit of an ass, is so important in English law and liberty, because he fought hard for that principle that the king was subject to law. Magna Carta, for example, was a fellow that shall have no sovereign, in his words. The king was subject to the rules. And that English rights came not from the king or from the Norman conqueror. They came from way before that, way before, from, he declared, time out of the mind of man. When at his leisure, otherwise known as unemployed, Cook wrote his Institutes of the Laws of England, which is one of those works that underpins liberty in England and whose covers bear the stains of generations of tears of love from passionate legal historians. Anyway, this idea of the ancient origin of a supreme law flew like a fly right into the face of absolutism. In the end, James rather took the coward's way out, usually known as the sensible way out, and dissolved Parliament. But he was forced to recall Parliament in 1624, but through his political talents, although forced to make some concessions, he managed to avoid damaging confrontation. Though interestingly, one of the concessions he made was to agree that Parliament could debate foreign policy. Up to this point, foreign policy was seen as the monarch's business and no one else's. It's a nibble, nothing more than that, but it's another nibble at royal prerogative. I don't know about you, but James the Sixth and First also seems like a sort of between times. I fear we do him a disservice as it happens, but such is life. Because the rest of the 17th century is such a time of upheaval and change as to sort of make his reign disappear into the background. But nonetheless, it's important. The first period of upheaval then came, of course, with the reign of Charles I and the resulting interregnum, including the period now known as the War of Three Kingdoms, since the civil war in England and Wales is simply impossible to understand without the context of revolution in Ireland and Scotland. Now, it is a fascinating period of history, and I would love to spend an age on it. I mean, more than that. I burn to. But now is not the time. I am not going to do so, otherwise it would not be long before you feel your brain dribbling from your collective ear, and we don't want that. Much has become concentrated in historical terms on the personality of Charles I for causing the Civil War. Maybe too much now, but hey. There are four things I want you to know about Charlie Boy. 1. Unlike Simba, he was not meant to be king. His brother Henry was so groomed, and unfortunately he died in 1612. 2. As far as the lesson of the divine right of kings was concerned, Charles followed the instructions of my teachers all those years ago and read, learned, and inwardly digested the philosophy, without necessarily doing the same with the second half of the lesson, that the king was also responsible for good governance. 3. Charles had never been to Scotland and was an inflexible sort of soul. 4. Although Charles could not be described as a thrifty soul, to be fair to him, the English were a measly lot and have never properly organised a suitable level of financing for the state by that time. So the trouble with Charles in England started quite early, which we should briefly cover before sweeping the Civil War aside. His problems started with that hardy perennial lack of money, fuelled by foreign war and the policy of possibly the best-dressed man in English history, George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham. Charles cheated, raising a forced loan. "Foul!" cried five knights. "The king cannot raise what is effectively taxation without parliamentary approval." Charles refused to change his mind, which was essentially one of his core features and essentially the way he rolled. And he insisted that the king's command was just that, a command, and those five knights should be lobbed into prison without trial, which they duly were. Well, that got Edward Coke proper blazing, and make no mistake, and Parliament blazed with him. So eventually a deal was struck. Parliament voted Charles his money, but he would have to pay by reconfirming some apparently ancient rights, due to Englishmen since time immemorial. In fact, of course, said rights were not the dues of Englishmen since time immemorial, but such was Cook's belief and his clever tactic. Hey, we're not the perpetrator of hideous innovation, good Lord no. Simply confirming what's already ours. Traditionalists, that's what we are, traditionalists. So now we come at last to the moment I know you've all been waiting for. I speak, of course, of the writ of habeas corpus. Now, I don't know about your households, but in mine, habeas corpus was mentioned more than once, though often at the time I was more interested in Leeds United and the title chase. Essentially, the writ of habeas corpus assures that no one can be held indefinitely without trial, even if the king says so. And who can argue it isn't a pivotal and fundamental liberty? Embedded also in the Petition of Right in 1628 were other principles. The king could not raise taxes, he could not declare martial law or billet troops upon his subjects without parliamentary approval. Now, Charles was so disgusted by the whole affair that he refused to call Parliament for 11 years, until the victorious Scots gave their king a bit of a kicking, and he then promptly called the English Parliament to help him out with the arrival of the so-called Long Parliament, and the Civil War was duly on. That, without doubt, is the worst summary of the causes of the Civil War ever. But my job today is really to talk about the constitutional and legal impacts of the good old cause. I think it's reasonable to say that when all is said and done, and there's a royal backside back on the throne, what the tumultuous events of 1640 to 1660 had changed in constitutional terms is viewed with a vague cloud of dissatisfaction hanging over the heads of us Republicans. Was it all really for so little? Is there a sense, maybe, that the English Revolution, which happened so much earlier than its more famous equivalents, happened too early? Well, you probably know the outline. Between 1640 and 1642, Parliament and the King try to sort things out. Parliament passes a number of changes, and those passed to 1641 would survive the Restoration. Things broke down eventually, resulting in two civil wars, 1642 to 46, and in 1648. After the King was executed, slowly the interregnum appears and the protectorate of Oliver Cromwell, which struggles and kicks and screams but finally fails after Cromwell's death. And in 1660, the monarchy is restored. It should probably be clear that the Civil War did not resolve the underlying struggle for a long-lasting constitution, since within just 30 years there'd be another revolution, though of a very different complexion. So, what did those 20 years of strife and all that blood achieve? Well, the entire tenor of the period, when compared to so much of England's history, is revolutionary. London, in particular, was an absolute boiling mass of eels, a flowering of political and religious debate never before seen, even in the Reformation, and the flowering of a public space of debate. Debate, again, referred back to perceived traditional liberties, but now a strong element of radicalism was creeping into English protest and political debate. Sometimes the two melded. So, Honest John Lilburne. You wouldn't expect me to go this episode without talking about Honest John Lilburne. He declared that his rights as a freeman were as the greatest man in England, and the ground of my freedom I build on the Grand Charter of England. The combination of reference to traditional rights and a rather radical appeal for equality is striking. Movements like the Diggers, Quakers, Ranters and so on proclaimed the uncorking of the bottle of religious freedom for nonconformists, and despite the strength of the Anglican Church in the future and the bonfire of nonconformist pastors on the Restoration, the cork could never be shoved back in again, and nonconformism will be a fact of life in English religious, social and political life to its enormous benefit. One of the core sources of radicalism would prove to be the army, which would produce in 1647 the very modern-sounding Heads of Proposals, sponsored by grandees such as Fairfax, Ireton and Cromwell. Among other things, the Heads of Proposals proposed biennial parliaments, reform of representation in Parliament so that it was linked more accurately to regional variations in wealth and population, parliamentary control of the army and navy, and appointment of great officers of state, and a national church with bishops, but alongside it, individual freedom to worship according to their own consciences. The same year, the Levellers got hold of this at the Putney debates, presided over by the same grandees, and they made their demands yet more radical. Now there is talk of inalienable native rights to freedom of religion, freedom from impressment for military service, equality under the law. The idea of inalienable natural rights will have a long and exciting future. Maybe the most ringing declaration of the Civil War came at these debates from the lips of a man called Thomas Rainsborough. "The poorest he that is in England hath a life to live as the greatest he. I think it is clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first by his own consent to put himself under that government. And I do think that the poorest man in England, is not at all bound in a strict sense to that government that he hath not had a voice to put himself under. Amongst the appeal of the Levellers and much of the radicalism of the interregnum, we hear therefore that refrain that all men are equal. We should of course qualify this, rather like the US Constitution 100 and some years later, that didn't mean everyone still got the vote. The concept property remained strong, that unless you owned a stake in the country, you should not get the franchise. And there were no claims for equality for women, or not in the mainstream anyway. The heads of proposal were at least in part enshrined in England's only ever written constitution, the Instruments of Government, produced in the 1650s to underpin the Protectorate, whose first protector was, of course, Oliver Cromwell. It was written mainly by a man called John Lambert, who really should have been Cromwell's replacement, not his useless son. The instrument, of course, did not survive the Restoration. But hey, at least we had a constitution. In fact, it is with deep irony that I read in the Encyclopaedia Britannica that this makes the Commonwealth of England, Scotland and Ireland the first detailed written constitution adopted by a modern state. So, we got out of the blocks fast and off to a flyer, and frankly, got a stitch pretty soon after the first corner and were thoroughly knackered by the time we got to the home straight. Wikipedia goes for Sweden, actually, under Axel Oxenstierna in 1634, but cleverly fudges it with the word detailed. In practical terms, what survived the restoration of the monarch in 1660 were a series of statutes passed before 1641, the most eye-catching, I suppose, being the abolition of the Court of Star Chamber. From a court of fast justice tempered with mercy, Star Chamber had become what it had always threatened to become, an uncontrolled instrument of arbitrary royal power, used by Archbishop Laud to enforce his religious reforms on a reluctant nation. Star Chamber dies, but the spirit of equity as part of common law survived. Two more things to mention then. Freeborn John Lilburne and his Levellers were, of course, a great part of the story of the Civil War, as well as being the inspiration for one of the world's best electric folk bands. Freeborn John and Cromwell were early brothers-in-arms and associates. If you want an interesting representation of those changing relationships, you'd do worse than to watch the TV series The Devil's Whore, in which Dominic West does a rather good fist of the changing face of Cromers. Anyway, as Cromers became more and more concerned with stability, he and Freeborn John drifted apart, and indeed, champion of radicalism though he is, Freeborn John was undoubtedly a little, well, cussed, shall we say, argumentative. By the time he died in 1657, his poor body was exhausted with all the arguing, reflected in his epigram. Is John departed, and is Lilburn gone? Farewell to both Lilburn and to John. Yes, being dead, take this advice from me, let them both not in one grave buried be. But lay John here, lay Lilburn here about, but if they ever meet, they will fall out. This inevitably ended with Lilburn in jail, but honest John, probably predictably, refused to yield, and he demanded that he be tried. Even though the writ of habeas corpus to which he appealed as his authority was apparently a right proceeding from the king's prerogative, and England at that time was a little short on kings. Nonetheless, John won his argument and stood trial against frankly overwhelming evidence. For 5 hours, he harangued the court. He picked at every single piece of procedure and finally ringingly appealed to the jury for justice. The jury by law are not only judges of fact, but of law also. And if you that call yourself judges of the law are in fact no more than Norman intruders, and indeed and in truth, if the jury please are no more but ciphers to pronounce their verdict. Well, the jury obliged and proved that they were not ciphers, and they set John free. The cheering rang round Guildhall as everyone went potty with excitement. Bonfires were lit in celebration. Freeborn John indeed. It is probably this more than anything which lodged habeas corpus permanently at the heart of English liberties. Right then, there is one other thing I'm sure that I ought to mention about the English Civil War. What could that be now? Give me a moment. Oh, of course. The very first execution of a crowned monarch authorised in a court of law. That's the one. By 1649, part of the revolutionary government and the army was sick to death of a king who simply refused to negotiate in good faith. All of Charles's failings came to the fore when the country tried to come to put a post-war settlement together. His utter intellectual inflexibility, his stubbornness, his duplicity. In this situation, even his courage became a disadvantage. It is worth noting, though, that very few people were actively looking for a republic, very few indeed. I probably don't need to emphasise to you, who have heard it many times, their reverence to the king was ingrained in Europe's population. The idea of God's anointed was not just verbiage, as shown by the later tradition of Charles's martyrdom. But those who were determined that the man of blood must pay for his crimes just like any other man, and that lasting peace was no longer possible while Charles was alive, these people, and Cromwell was powerful among them, were equally determined that this must be done in the public gaze and by a court of law. In 1660, a regicide called Harrison would come to trial after Charles II's return. He proudly declared of the regicide, "I do not come to be denying anything, but rather to be bringing it forth to light. It was not a thing done in a corner." Ah, the good old cause. The trial of Charles I was high theatre. Westminster Hall was all decked out, the public were admitted, all were agog. But there was a fundamental problem here, and Charles I would play it hard. Mary Queen of Scots had used it too, but not so relentlessly. The question was, who could try a king? The Long Parliament had relentlessly pursued the king's ministers and embedded Parliament's right to condemn them, but what court was competent to condemn a king? What charge should be made, since treason was an offence against the king? Who were the king's peers that could try him? Charles knew all this and refused at any point to plead or to recognise the competence of the court. A couple of routes suggested themselves. One was the increasingly popular notion of ancient liberties from Saxon times before the monarchical Norman yoke. Another was to take advantage of the idea discovered in Edward II's reign, that the king, as a person, was different to the king in his role, and if the king biological, as it were, betrayed his role as king in Parliament, well, maybe he was fair game. A Puritan slogan was, "Fighting the king to defend the king," with the second king using a capital K. As the king approached Westminster Hall, Cromwell asked his companions to decide by what authority and commission we do try him. Into the silence came the words from one of them, "In the name of the commons in Parliament assembled and all the good people of England." In the end, John Cook, Charles's prosecutor, essentially indicted Charles for war crimes, and he made tyranny a treasonable offence. As support leaked away and people recoiled from such an extraordinary, earth-shattering event, Charles, despite his obduracy, was condemned. Its legality was undeniably endowed with industrial levels of legal dodginess. But what else were they to do? This was an event that shook Europe. Cardinal Mazarin in France talked of the tears that would fall. One diarist compared the English to wolves, Another condemned the execution as the most horrible and detestable parricide ever to be committed by Christians. Interestingly, the political and diplomatic reaction was rather more circumspect. No wars were declared, and many were cautious of declaring Charles's son king, even. But that's politics for you. There is no doubt this was a seminal event in European history. One modern biographer of Cook identifies it as the first political trial of a head of state for crimes against the people. A king had been found accountable. Do not be fooled into thinking, though, that this was a spontaneous view of the whole English, Irish and Scottish people. It was anything but. And in death, Charles was at his most dignified and courageous best. But still, a king had been found accountable and subject to law, and that could never be scrubbed out. Now then, let us put the Civil War into the rearview mirror and turn to the events of the later 17th century and the restored Stuart monarchy and the glorious Revolution. Or, if you are feeling clever and slightly arsy, you call it the Dutch invasion and then lean back and look smug as though no one has ever said that before. Or, if you are Irish, you'd probably mutter that it was anything but glorious, the sucky revolution more like. In Scotland at the time, you'd possibly been a bit split, but I think England and Wales probably went together on this. Anyway, enough. What happens? Well, we should note first that Charles II returned along with what was called a convention parliament, which basically means it's not a parliament, because parliament has to be called by a king, and all the various nations were a little slice short in the king department. It's quite remarkable in this constitutional story where a convenient fiction or a little white lie was helpful in moving the nation towards a modern constitution and civil liberties. I would love to talk more about Charles II, the King of Bling, as I believe horrible histories have dubbed him. He's a fascinating character. I once saw a wonderful programme with Lucy Worsley where she had a map showing where all Charles's mistresses were located in relation to his chambers. But that all has to be for the future, for we all are here not to be distracted by fripperies from the serious business of the Constitution. And there can be no sex in a Constitution. So, I'm going to mention two things about Charles II's reign. First of all, we finally start to see the emergence of political parties. Yay! I introduce you, ladies and gentlemen, to the Whigs and to the Tories. Now, remove all thought about the apparatus of modern political parties, Whig and Tory, have very loose connections of loyalties and shared interests and views. There are no whips here. Well, there are, but they were for horses or for occasions when he needed to bark, "Damn you, sir, you deserve to be horsewhipped," that sort of thing. The core values around which these two groups emerged are around that issue of Charles's reign. Of religion. It has always seemed to me that most of the Stuarts were rather more attractive in terms of religious toleration than English history in particular have given them credit for. Essentially, both Charles II and his brother James II and VII were keen to deliver much wider religious toleration, essentially for Catholics as well as for non-conforming Protestants. Pretty much no one else in England agreed. And they suspected that really both Charles and James basically wanted to use the idea of toleration as a blind to reimpose Catholicism. Bear in mind that once again in the background, raising the temperature and the heat, is the Catholic persecution of the Huguenots in France and the flight of hundreds of thousands of French Protestants, some of them to England. So the Stuart declarations of indulgence, trying to free Catholics from penal legislation, resulted in two test acts forced on the crown by Whig parliaments. Basically, the test acts required an oath of allegiance to the royal supremacy and a rejection of transubstantiation before you could take any public office. And this ruled out Catholics from public office. What we have here then, very crudely, are those oriented towards nonconformism and the primacy of Parliament and civil liberties, who are referred to as Whigs. Those who supported the divine right of kings and the established Anglican Church, the Tories. Both terms, interesting enough, derive from insults. So, on to James II, who I think, like James I, was hardly an evil man, but was just inflexible and determined to see Catholicism flourish in an age where religious tension and suspicion was still very high, and using methods to get his way which were seen as tyrannical, and probably were. One example of his political incompetence was the celebrated trial of the seven bishops, thrown into jail by the king for refusing to support the king's prerogative right to release people from the religious test acts and therefore put Catholics in positions of power without consultation with Parliament. To the riotous joy of the population, a jury promptly found the bishops not guilty. What would we do without rogue jurors? So, one in the eye for tyranny, take that, you bounder. Although, just to add, also one in the eye for religious toleration, so... The long and short is that a group of Whigs invited the most Protestant king of the Netherlands to come and save English liberties and the Protestant religion. William of Orange was in fact the husband of the real claimant to the throne, Mary Stuart, and initially at least invaded in her name. James essentially legged it, though returned to fight in Ireland and then re-leg it. William was proclaimed king and the terms of his enthronement agreed by two convention parliaments, one in England and one in Scotland. The decision in Scotland was much closer and of course would lead to a strand of Jacobitism in Scotland, that is, support for the Stuart cause. Now, the reason why clever people call it an invasion, apart from the enormous army, of course, is that William refused to be shoved into the background as Mary II's consort, but insisted on the full fatness of his regality. And also because William's focus really wasn't to bring truth, light and freedom to the North Atlantic archipelago, it was to help him keep the Dutch Republic out of the grubby, conquering, absolutist hands of Louis XIV. Which, it must be said, was a most excellent objective. But it didn't quite fit into the Whig narrative. But the reason you might call it glorious, quite apart from the fact that the blood count was a tiny fraction of the blood count of the Wars of Three Kingdoms, is that as part of the deal, the political settlement confirmed, extended, and wrote down many liberties for which the political nation had been fighting for centuries. These, both from 1689, are called the Bill of Rights. It is worth noting that the bill contains nothing like as much as many politicians wanted to in the Declaration of Rights that they had put together beforehand, and why not is quite interesting. It was because, like most parts of the British Constitution, this was a negotiation. Even Whig politicians didn't want to go too far and risk annoying the king, because then he could nix their careers and destroy their opportunity for patronage. So, when we describe the British Constitution as a political constitution, here is one reason why. Changes and developments were constantly the result of the art of the political possible. There was only one point, the Civil War, and the instruments of government, where the ruling government had been removed and a blank piece of paper used to create a new constitution. Never happened again. It's a process that is a lot less clean, ambitious and exciting, but also a lot less bloody, divisive and disruptive. Anywho, the Bill of Rights 1689 declared its purpose was to vindicate and assert the true, ancient and indubitable rights of the people of this kingdom. You might note, once more, the claim to a complete lack of innovation. All existing rights, gov, nothing new here, move along. Specifically, the king's prerogative was once again shaved. The monarch could no longer suspend or dispense with laws through his prerogative. Everything had to be done or changed through Parliament. Personal liberties were protected from excessive bail or fines, juries protected. The king was now required to call parliaments frequently, which is a little vague, but it was given teeth by the Mutinies Act. By the what, I hear you ask? Well, to go back to that question you asked about what was really changed by the civil wars, one thing was instilling a terror in the British political system of standing armies, in memory of the dominance of that horribly radical new model army. So, the Mutiny Act required that if the king wanted to pay a standing army, that expenditure had to be approved every year by Parliament. Since there were always some men in uniform hanging around somewhere, this essentially meant that Parliament was now a permanent part of the political system. No more was Parliament an event rather than an institution. By the time of the Bill of Rights, that journey was settled. Parliament was at the core of the Constitution. Indeed, Parliament was supreme. It could change the Constitution at will, opening up the prospect of the tyranny of the majority, it should be noted. The Bill of Rights needs to be seen in conjunction with two other acts. The Act of Toleration in 1689 finally broke the 1,000-year search in the British Isles for that rather odd Christian lust for religious uniformity. The Act gave specific freedom to worship for Protestant dissenters, the right to have their own schools and so on. However, penal laws still applied if you were not to take the oaths of supremacy and allegiance to the crown, and made a declaration against transubstantiation. If you didn't do that, you couldn't take up any public office. Since Catholics were specifically excluded from the Act and had no right to assemble to practice their religion, this is a good way from full religious liberty. We'll have to wait to 1829 for that. However, it is more significant than it looks. While the heart of discrimination against Catholics still beat hard in the English breast, the Act of preventing Catholics from practicing their religion was ended, although in this regard, it probably had been ended for some time. The Act in practical terms meant that no one would be pursued for practicing their religion. The practice that was widespread in the Netherlands of Catholic worship that took place in plain sight but was ignored despite the official religion of the state was now firmly established in England. The other act to mention is the Act of Settlement in 1701 after Mary II's death and the prospect after Anne that the next in line would be, shock horror, Charles Stuart. The Act of Settlement ruled that out, an agreement which was much harder to get the Scots and the Irish to agree than the Welsh and the English. The Act applied the Test Acts to the monarch, so that meant that a Catholic could not succeed to the throne, and this would eventually usher in the Hanoverian line after Anne Stuart died. Well, good golly, Miss Molly. So now there really is no restriction whatsoever to Parliament's scope of competence. The idea of a simple hereditary succession was dead, and the right of Parliament to approve the succession fully established. Together, these acts not only clearly established principles and practice of English liberty, but decisively moved the balance of power from king to people. In the next episode, folks, we will spend a deal of time thinking about the separation of the executive from the royal prerogative. Nota bene that the crown still possesses enormous power. It selects the government in the form of its ministers. It controls patronage, and that means it can heavily influence MPs and Parliament. The king also retained some power to influence justice in a way that would leave anyone who believed in separation of powers calling Aunt Ethel for the smelling salts. The late 17th century had seen significant changes that reinforced the independence of the judiciary. The removal of Star Chamber, for one, and then in the 1670s came the famous Bushells case, which was prompted by the actions of one William Penn, who preached to 300 or 400 nonconformists at a meeting, which he was not allowed to do as a nonconformist. So a court case ensued, remembering that this is before the Act of Toleration in 1689. Now Penn fixed the jury in the eye and declaimed, "You are Englishmen, mind your privilege. Give not away your right." Lawyers, eh? They do like grand phrases. Speechwriters, manquez the lot of them. Well, the Crown was not at all pleased when the jury declared the defendant innocent. So the judge sent them away to think again. Several times. And when they came back with the same answer, "No, wrong answer. Try again." The recorder, meanwhile, was livid. "Look, the judge had made it clear what the law said," he raged. "The decision by the jury was contrary to the full and manifest evidence and to the direction of the court." And he fined all the jurors and he threw them in jail. Now, this is a fundamental problem. If the king or his agents can come along and tell a jury, no, wrong answer, and then threaten and intimidate them, what price justice? Bushell, one of the defendants, thought the same, and he took the case to the Chief Justice. And there, John Vaughan ruled that the jury had an absolute right to find a verdict contrary to the advice of the court, and that no jury could be fined, imprisoned, or punished for any verdict. Thus was established their basic principle, cry Harry, and all that. The further piece of the puzzle lay again in the Act of Settlement, which included some further limitations on royal power, and one crucial one. At the time, judges were appointed to their role according to the king's pleasure. Well, you can see how dangerous such a description should be, how it could be abused by a tyrant. "Oh, your judgments aren't pleasurable to me, you're cancelled." So, the Act of Settlement fixed it. It specified that judges could only be removed if their behaviour transgressed, and then only by an Act of Parliament. And thus another critical check on royal power was established, independence of the justice system reinforced, and protection of individual liberties put in place. Now, I aim to finish this little series in 5 episodes, because I think that surely this must be the limit of anyone's tolerance for law and constitutional history. That means there are 2 more episodes only available to me and 300 years to cover in them, so I must cover 2 more topics before I end this episode. The union of Scotland and England into Great Britain, and a character called John Locke. The Onion first. Well, it's a matter of some controversy. If you want a bit of fun, go onto Twitter and tweet, "Hey, wasn't the Act of Union 1707 great?" and see what happens. Reasons for Scottish dislike range from disapproval at the manner of its negotiation to dislike of the content to downright hatred of the very idea. And as we speak, who knows how much longer it has to run. Let me stick to the facts then. The background is a period in the 1690s of great economic dislocation and famine in Scotland, and of international war, plus the failure of Scotland's attempt to get stuck into the business of colonisation, the Darien Project, which conclusively crashed and burned. England's involvement in these crises was not notably neighbourly. It focused economic and trade support on its own businesses and actively stood aside from helping out in the Darien Project when things got rocky. Well, you know, competition between nations and all of that. When negotiations started then between the commissioners of England and Scotland, these issues were pressing. Scotland absolutely needed access to English markets and English support for international trade to dig itself out of its economic hole. Also, when the Scottish leadership looked around Europe, they could not but notice the growth of large-scale nations of much greater power than Scotland had, and Scotland's security was therefore threatened. For the English, the prize of the Onion was glittering in terms of security. Freedom from the centuries-long habit of the Scots to stab them in the back at inconvenient moments. Well, competition between nations and all that. So, an agreement that there would be no separate monarch for Scotland on Queen Anne's death would mean no longer that ever-present worry about security. And so the deal was done. Protections were put in place for the Scottish religious settlement, and Scottish law was to remain. It is, in many ways, a very odd agreement, very much contra to the idea that nations need to be standard. Different systems and rights remained very much in place. The Scottish Parliament, meanwhile, was removed, and the Scots allotted 45 seats in the new House of Commons of Great Britain and 16 peers in the House of Lords of Great Britain. In the process of making the agreement and getting it through the Scottish Parliament, the accusation is that bribery was used by the English. The amounts and impacts are rather debated. I have to tell you, though, that the history of Parliament in both Scotland and England in the 17th century is riddled with the use of bungs and inducements of various kinds. Anyway, the Scottish people, as opposed to their political leaders, seem to have hated it. The Scottish Kirk, it's true, was happy enough with the settlement, but many presbyteries and congregations signed petitions, joining a stream of anti-union protest. I am told not one petition was sent in favour. Whether the resulting 300 years of economic growth, the glories of Scottish Enlightenment, the extraordinary creativity of Scottish and English engineers, writers, lawyers and so on during these 300 years, and the shared project of empire proved worth it for both sides, I will leave you to judge. I think both sides got a lot out of it, but no one's asking me, and I suspect we're done. Hopefully we'll have a good divorce party, fuelled by English ale and Scottish whisky. This all brings me then to John Locke. I worry about talking about any philosophers because I just don't have the brain for it. I don't know what it is. Someone once tried to explain the theory of forms to me, and I still haven't really recovered. So let me be brief and stick to a few points about the political theorising. John Locke's two treatises on civil government were published in 1690 and form the core of his political fame. I suspect that John Locke's popularity during the American Tax Rebellion owes a lot to his fame there, since his 18th century popularity was never mega in England. And recently, of course, it's been pointed out that he invested in slavery and contributed to a draft of the Laws of Carolina, which embedded absolute control of masters over slaves. Though to leaven that bread, Locke's first words in his first treatise of government were, "Slavery is so vile and miserable an estate of man, and so directly opposite to the generous temper and courage of our nation, that it is hardly to be conceived that an Englishman, much less a gentleman, should plead for it." His work and theory on religious toleration was massively influential and contributed towards the growing strength of religious toleration in England. In addition, his work provided the theoretical justification for the removal of James II and VII. He argued that power, whether legislative or executive, was granted on trust for the attainment of an end, and when that end was neglected or opposed, the power was forfeited. And before you ask who judges whether the end is attained or not, well, in Locke's view, the people should be the judge. The resistance to the monarch in circumstances where trust was forfeited was the final expression of the sovereignty of the people. Martin Loughlin argues that Locke is part of a very English and British tradition of Bacon, Hobbes, Locke and Hume. A tendency towards utility, towards pragmatism, rather than the later rationalism that begins to generate written constitutions based on highfalutin theory and aspirations. Do not email me about this statement. If you want to raise questions about these philosophers, you might want to approach Martin. However, a later commentator in the 20th century, Michael Oakeshott, agreed, arguing that the error of rationalism is to discount practical knowledge acquired from usage and experience. Now, that's been a long episode, and so before we end, I thought I should summarise a little. What is the arc of the 17th century all about? How was England different at the end of it, constitutionally speaking? Well, we started with a king proclaiming the divine right of kings, and down that avenue gaily went most of Europe during the century. We ended with the death of Anne, with a very different political entity. Parliament's competence spanned the entire constitution, and its will was supreme, and with it, the will of the people to which the king was subject. The king was subject and accountable to law and that people's will. Judicial institutions were independent to the king's will. Parliament was a permanent institution now with political groupings. Despite this, government and politics were still focused on the king. The king might not be absolute, but he had enormous powers of patronage and appointed and managed the executive. The monarch's will was a critical component of the constitution, together then with Parliament. We are ready then for the next chapter, where the Enlightenment begins to change attitudes, where radicalism becomes radicalism and a desire for change, not just an appeal to ancient rights. And we have the appearance of written constitutions. You are, I am sad to say, going to have to wait for that until the 13th of May. In the interim, we'll have another brace of Margaret Beaufort episodes. I appreciate that Scotland seems to have got lost a bit, but do not fear, it will reappear eventually. We've got a great period coming up in Scottish history, and we can't miss that. Oakley Doakley all, thanks very much for listening, and thank you for being members very much. Please feel free to comment anytime on content or general matters. It is always good to get feedback. So thanks to all of you, and I shall return on the 23rd of May with Margaret Beaufort. Good luck, everyone.